Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a combined project of KCBX and our team of program hosts. Today on Central Coast Voices, host Fred Monroe and his guest, Cal Poly Professor of Political Science, Dr. Michael Lattner, will help us to better understand the 14th Amendment, the Voting Rights Act, and equality justice under law. The more we understand, the safer our democracy will remain. We're live today, and we invite you to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation. We can once again take your calls, and we can do that live with them at 805-781-3875. And with that, let's join Fred Monroe and his guest. Over to you,
Thank
Fred.
You, Brad. Good to see be with you today. This is Central Coast Voices, of course, and welcome. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. Our goal is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. We want to address how today's choices affect tomorrow's community. While Central Coast Voices has endeavored to keep our focus as local as possible, sometimes the line between local issues and national issues is hard to define. In defining that line, sometimes we're talking about topics that really fit in both areas, both as a local concern as a national concern. In this case, sometimes it's citizenship, voting rights, due process of law under the Constitution. And this is, yes, a national topic, but it becomes really important to us also. And we are lucky and grateful for having a local scholar with us that helps us better understand this series of national challenges going on in our republic right now. Michael Lattner is a professor of political science at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. He is also, and I'll be precise on this because I was going to ask Michael to kind of explain what this involves. He is also director of research and democratic reform at the Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard Law School. He is not in the studio with us today. He's really on the phone with us because he's in Cambridge, Massachusetts right now at Harvard. He's going to help us better understand the challenges facing us with the 14th Amendment and some arguments going on, if you will, with folks as to what the 14th Amendment does with regard to citizenship rights. He also is a very well-studied individual on the Voting Rights Act, hard to phrase sometime. And we'll get a better understanding from him. Again, 805-781-3875 is the number to give us a call. We would hope that you can participate with us in the conversation and maybe some of the questions. Michael, glad to have you with us. It's always nicer when you're in the room with us, but we're glad that you're available today to come talk with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Fred. I will say it's one of those days in Cambridge where I'm missing California because it's horribly humid and raining.
Well, hopefully there's no flooding.
Yeah. No, not to that extent.
Yeah. Michael, what I'd like to start out with, only because I'm sure that our listeners, when I tried to explain about the Houston Institute and your position with that, it probably is easy to define but hard to understand if one only knows the title. So tell us about your work with the Houston Institute and what it involves.
Sure. So I should say at the front that, you know, I'm speaking on behalf of myself and not as a representative of Harvard or the Institute. I'm a political scientist by training. I'm not a constitutional scholar, not an attorney. But most of the work that I do and have done for most of my career is right at the intersection of constitutional design and electoral system design in particular. And our Constitution does not say much about electoral design, the type of elections that we have. And again, just to clarify, electoral systems, what I mean by that are the rules that we use to elect people to public office. So not so much election administration and voter registration, stuff like that, but really what are the fundamental rules in terms of how big is the legislature, what are the how do we elect representatives, what are the rules that parties have to abide by, and the like. And so My work here at the Houston Institute involves something that comes out of what's called the Lonnie Guinier Project. Lonnie Guinier was a professor here at Harvard Law School, and she is an icon within the voting rights movement, in part because she was such a pioneer, and she was one of the early scholars to really take social science seriously and bring in social science into legal discussions and to better understand how social science can work in the courtroom at this intersection. And she's really responsible for beginning what would become a very important partnership between social science and constitutional law, election law in particular, and the emergence of election law as a sub-discipline within legal studies. And that would, in turn, build on the argument that that we can use social science, and indeed social science has become a very important part of how we protect voting rights in the United States through the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act and the rules and tests that we use in order to identify racial discrimination, to remedy racial discrimination in voting. And that is in part a result of Guinier's commitment, as well as her criticism of the way that courts and advocates go about providing remedies. And so one of those criticisms was the excessive reliance on single-seat districts to provide a remedy for racial discrimination, that is essentially carving out an electoral district so that a minority, African-Americans or Latino-Americans or Asian-Americans or other groups protected under the Voting Rights Act could be a majority within that district. And that became the sort of default remedy in the 1970s and 80s. There was some pushback against the idea of using race as a predominant factor in drawing up districts and redistricting. And so we are at a stage now, and we can hopefully talk about this in some greater detail, where that basic consensus that we can use race-conscious districting as a remedy for racial discrimination in voting and to remedy vote dilution, that consensus is broken down now. And I think that when we look at recent decisions from the Supreme Court, and certainly when we look at the current Department of Justice and the Civil Rights Department within the Department of Justice, we can see that is not a priority for the federal government anymore. And so that's going to require some thinking in terms of you know, how do groups that are concerned about political equality and protecting voting rights for all citizens in the U.S., what can we do to make sure that those rights are protected? Because, after all, it is, the right to vote is really the fundamental right from which all of our other rights grow out of.
I want to bring it back locally for a moment. Well, not for a moment. It actually could be a good portion of our conversation. The way in which elections are now conducted in the city of San Luis Obispo has changed based upon some court rulings. We have been so caught up in over the last 6 months or so with the 14th Amendment and citizenship and voting rights generally. I feel like we've lost track of what San Luis Obispo was enjoined to do basically by court ruling. Can you give us a better understanding of that particular local issue?
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually a very good way to enter into this conversation so that your audience can understand the magnitude and the way that this affects our lives locally, statewide, and federally as well. So the California Voting Rights Act, which is a state statute that is distinct from the federal Voting Rights Act of 1965. It has a number of provisions that are quite similar to the Federal Voting Rights Act, but it you know, there are some differences, and it has been used extensively since it was first implemented in early 2000s to identify cities, typically cities that elect their electoral systems are what we call at-large. And so people who live in San Luis Obispo and most of the cities on the Central Coast are aware of the sort of general model for a city in California, which is a five-seat city council where you have a rotating mayor, and all five of those seats are elected at what's known as at-large, so that typically elections are staggered, so you'll have a two-seat election 1 year and a three-seat election 2 years after that. The terms are 4 years, and that's been the basic model for general law cities throughout California. A number of cities, not just San Luis Obispo, but several other cities on the Central Coast as well, have recently, over the last 10 years or so, been forced to adopt district elections. And what I mean by single district elections are you take the city, you chop it up into five equally populated districts, and then you hold separate elections. And so we're electing a city council now more or less the same way that we elect Congress, where we have 435 single-seat elections. So we don't really have a national election for Congress. We have 435 little elections every 2 years. And the idea there is that, again, you're identifying communities that are geographically concentrated or segregated, which is a fact of life in America, that different racial groups tend to be geographically segregated. And that's how this single-seat remedy came about, right? It turns out, though, that in California, when we look at Latino populations, for example, that we don't have the kind of geographic segregation that was characteristic of, say, African-American populations in the Deep South in the 1960s. Right? This is when the Voting Rights Act was originally designed and when the remedies for discrimination of vote dilution, and I should just quickly describe what vote dilution is.
Yeah, so, please do.
So let's say in the city of San Luis Obispo, hypothetically, that you have white candidates and Latino-supported candidates running for those city council races. In an at-large election, let's say a three-seat election, the typical at-large system is called a plurality block vote, which means that everyone gets the number of votes equal to the number of seats being elected. So if it's a three-seat election, everyone gets three votes that they can allocate to candidates, right? And when voting is racially polarized, that is, when you have the Latino population voting for different candidates than the white population, right, and the white population's larger, which means that white voters all have three votes, Latino voters all have three votes. But if the largest group votes as a block, they can control all three seats, right, because they all have three votes. And so even if they're not a majority, the largest block of voters can control every seat. And that is what we mean by vote dilution. So even though, let's say, Latino candidates get a third of the vote, they get 0% of the seats. Right. And so the Voting Rights Act is designed to fix that. The single seat district remedy, that is, break up the city into a bunch of districts, and then you have a majority Latino district, they can always elect their candidate of choice. That only works when there's enough geographic segregation so that you can actually create a majority minority district. And in the case of San Luis Obispo, that's impossible. Right? The most you can get, I think, looking at some of the maps that the plaintiffs offered, you can get a 30-35% Latino district voting age population.
Has anyone ever done any kind of research as to kind of what the minimum size of a community can be for this effectively to work?
Well, that's a good question, and there's actually been some really absurd examples of like special districts that are, we're talking about hundreds of people having to be split into districts under these lawsuits, and you run up with very practical problems in that case. So trying to find people to run for district offices for special, water districts and the like becomes very difficult, and it becomes sort of There's an absurdity there that we, you can't just break every political unit into smaller units and expect for it to function democratically. And so this was the case with San Luis Obispo, right? There's an alleged violation of the Voting Rights Act where there's allegations of vote dilution. What's the possible remedy? Well, in the case of San Luis Obispo, in many cities in California, there's no way to create majority-minority districts, even if there is racially polarized voting. And so you've got to look for alternatives, right? Because we definitely don't want to just allow vote dilution to go unchecked. That's fair. And what San Luis Obispo agreed to adopt as part of a settlement was what we call a limited vote in political science. And that means that instead of giving every voter three votes, you just give every voter a single vote, right? So a single non-transferable vote. And what that does effectively, whether you're electing two seats or three seats, or even four or five or seven seats, as I think would probably actually even perform better, is that prevents the largest group from controlling every seat. So even if you have a majority of white voters that will never support a Latino-supported candidate, right, they've still got to split their votes because they've only got one vote each. And so if there's three seats to fill, unless they have three times the votes, right, there's no way that they can control every seat. So that's how you tend to get minority population. And so we call those semi-proportional systems because they facilitate minority representation. And in this case, I mean minority. I mean numeric minority. I don't necessarily mean racial minority. So it could be, such as in the case of San Luis Obispo, there's a sort of no-growth contingency there, and they often compete with the progressive majority. Well, they're going to be in a better position now because of this new electoral system.
Has San Luis Obispo as an entity and the citizenry embrace this in such a way that they feel like they may not be getting 100% of what they need for a solution, but that it's workable and beneficial to the community?
Well, this is certainly a far better solution than chopping the city into districts. There's no question about that, because the analysis that follows a racial vote dilution claim means that you've got to show, and this is where the social science comes in, you've got to show whether or not voting is actually racially polarized, right? Are white voters and voters that are protected under the VRA, are they voting for competing candidates? And then secondly, does the dominant group win, right? Do they consistently prevent minority candidates from being elected? That's really what we mean by vote dilution. And in this case, there's no question that the limited vote is a better electoral system in terms of representation compared to the at-large system, because you don't want to deny minorities their voting strength, right? And there is something to be said, and I think every Californian and American understands this pretty intuitively, that everyone's vote should count the same. That is, everyone's vote should have equal weight. And what that means in terms of elections is that if you've got a candidate that earns 30% of the vote, or a coalition that is 30% of a city coalition, well, they should get about 30% of the seats.
Yeah,
right. That's fair. Think about if you had a pie, and you have three groups that are fighting over the pie. What's the fairest way to divide it up? Right. Most people understand it's intuitive that fair and effective representation equates to proportional representation.
Yeah, we could probably review this further, because it's a solution. We aren't looking at a solution that's necessarily the final solution at this point for that kind of situation. I want to move on a little bit. Well, first off, I want to remind folks they can give us a call at 805-781-3875. Michael Latner is with me, and we are looking at the among other things, the history of the Voting Rights Act and what's going on in constitutional struggles right now. Michael, it seems to cause some people to get kind of glassy-eyed when we talk about it, but we're really focusing more on these days on the issues of how people see the 14th Amendment. I have to confess, as a layman, the concept of the 14th Amendment not really assuring that everyone who was given citizenship has a right to that citizenship, I can't think of a word other than bewildering. But I understand that there's enough discussion about this allegedly having more shades of gray than I thought he ever existed, that it's taken over a lot of the discussion. In conversations you and I have had, the 14th Amendment and issue of citizenship really goes hand in hand with the Voting Rights Act, and I'd like to get a better understanding of how we got here.
Yeah, absolutely. There are, I think, two distinct issues at play when we're talking about the relevance of the 14th Amendment today. They are both certainly, I would say, implicated in the sort of autocratic legalism that we're experiencing as a country. But let me be more specific. So, the Voting Rights Act was passed by Congress, signed by the president in 1965, in specific reaction to the civil rights movement and the need to break down the caste system, the apartheid system that was part of the South after the failure of Reconstruction after the Civil War. Right? So in contemporary terms, the United States was not a democracy until the Voting Rights Act was passed, in that it was only after the Voting Rights Act ensured and had a means of enforcing political equality under the law that it was possible to do away with the sort of racial gerrymandering, the white primaries, and the other electoral mechanisms that were used to discriminate against primarily African American voters in the South. What the VRA does is it enforces the clause in the 14th Amendment that guarantees equal treatment under the law, right? And that's what the 14th Amendment guarantees. It was passed as part of the Civil War Amendment, the abolition of slavery, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. The other element of the 14th Amendment, and this is where I think most attention is going now, has to do with this question of who counts as a citizen, right?
Yeah, for a good portion of us, that seemed like a minor element of the 14th Amendment because it's, and I've gone back and read it a couple of times, yeah. It seems pretty black and white. But obviously the courts are telling us it's not.
Well, yeah. I mean, so prior to the Civil War, there were different rules for each state, right? Because the Constitution that was ratified in 1787 didn't answer the question of citizenship because it couldn't even answer the question of what counted as a human being, right?
Okay.
And whether enslaved people were property or they had full, you know, any citizenship right.
We need to remember that even though it's shocking that it existed.
The Constitution punted on a lot of things. Right, but by design, because the framers of the Constitution needed to put together a coalition that could actually pass a new Constitution. And the question of slavery kept all of those questions of citizenship and registration and lots of electoral content, basically kicked it down to the states, because that was the only way that they were going to ratify a national
Constitution. Let me step in for a second. So the issue that we're dealing with now as to birthright citizenship really was not originally written with a view of immigrants as much as it was written with a view of making sure there was equal protection under the law for everyone that was already here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. After the Civil War, once slavery was formally abolished, you now had a bunch of formerly enslaved people, as well as free black residents who had never been enslaved, who lived outside of the South, but they were never considered citizens in the states or by the courts. And to protect them and their descendants specifically, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, and that put the rule in the Constitution in the 14th Amendment that everyone who's born in the United States, and this is really important, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, is a citizen. That's exactly why that language is put in there.
Okay. Let me remind listeners that we would certainly invite you to be part of this discussion. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. This truly has a lot of possible points of discussion that we'd like you to be part of if you'd like to join us. Go ahead, Michael. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, that's great. And so, you know, there's now, and this does have local relevance, right? I mean, certainly for residents of California, the experience of people in their neighborhoods in Los Angeles, outside of Los Angeles, on the Central Coast, right? This has very real consequences for our neighbors and our families and our coworkers. And so it is something that people should be more informed about. And indeed, the Supreme Court has been very clear about what that language means. There was actually a specific case in 1898, U.S. versus Wong Kim Ark, that clarified what that language means, that it means that citizenship, birthright citizenship, applies to people of any race. And the reason that case actually came up was because of California, because the Chinese who had started coming to the West Coast, that became an explicit part of the conversation. And so, indeed, the question of whether immigrants count under this or not has already been dealt with by the Supreme Court in 1898.
Hi. We've got a call from Jim in Morro Bay. Hold on a second. Let me see if I can get him up here. Jim, you on the line? Let's see, I don't...
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
Hello.
You have a question about minority representation. I wanted to make sure that you got in here in the discussion.
So my observation is that I heard one of your speakers earlier say that if you have, say, a one-third of a particular minority, that they have a right to that much representation in the political system, whether it's local, state, or however. I don't believe that's what the framers intended, certainly not since 1964. You know, if you live in an area that has a lot of one group, you know, otherwise I would prefer districting. You know, if you want to make up a district, if you have more districts, say City of Los Angeles, but just to say, because I exist, I am guaranteed an outcome, that's equality of outcome. Not equality of opportunity. The opportunity is the right to vote, not to claim a right of representation based upon some kind of minority status.
Yeah, Jim, you actually raise a really important point, and so I should definitely clarify. When I was using those percentages to refer to a third of persons, I was referring to voters specifically. So I think you are absolutely right, and there is a there's a lot of disagreement over this, actually, as to whether some percentage of a voting age population is obliged to have some representation in a legislature. I'm speaking specifically of voters, right? So when I say that a third of voters, if a third of the vote goes to candidates supported by whoever, right? That those a third of those candidates should be seated. And so that's very different than what you're referring to, which is population proportionality.
You're talking about proportionality.
I'm talking about proportionality of voters, not of citizens or residents.
Okay.
Like voters.
I'm hearing you say that if there is a certain proportion of people who vote in a certain kind of block, whatever that may be, that and they are in the minority of the totality, that I heard you say that they have a right to be represented, even though if the system says, well, here's the majority and majority rules, that you're saying that the majority shouldn't rule. Now, if you end up with, if you end up with what's the word, and if you have an election, you don't have a clear majority.
A plurality.
Plurality. Yeah. If you have a plurality situation, then maybe you have to have another round of voting to get a clear majority. That's the way I see things being done in recent years.
Right. Yeah. So there's another distinction here, whether we're talking about a single seat, right, where, yes, obviously majority rule should prevail. That's part of what political equality requires. But also in a legislature, right, any voters, if a majority of voters votes for a certain party, let's say, in a legislature, then those voters should get a majority of seats. Would you not agree?
Within, you know, I guess it's hard to say I agree to the idea that if you're within a certain political domain of that vote, whether if you're talking legislatures, those are within specific districts. In Morro Bay, we have a Democratic legislative person and the person of Don Addis, you know?
That's right.
So you have one person. But if you're saying, well, gee, why don't we take three, you know, I mean, I don't know what kind of political entity where you have a group of people that you're going to say, well, we're going to carve out a third of this. You have to have something that has multiple seats in a given area. I mean,
That's exactly right. Multi-seat districts, right? So that's what the city of San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay have now for their city councils. They're multi-seat districts, right? The whole city is a
No. The city of Morro Bay only votes. You can vote for whoever you vote for, and there are no districts in Morro Bay.
That's exactly what I mean. So there's multiple seats. The whole city is a single district, right?
Right. But it's vote. So whoever has the most votes in order of the number of seats available in any given vote, the top vote getters, you know, 1, 2, 3, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yes, and so, but just
they don't clarify. They don't look to see if they belong to any kind of group. They're just straight up candidates.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but it depends on who's supporting which candidates, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so
well, no, it's
let me
just the city. We have one group of people.
Jim, I'm going to interrupt here for a second.
You know what?
I don't think we can come up with a clear answer at the moment.
Yeah, and I've got to go anyway.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for the call.
And I do appreciate the fact you guys are having a conversation.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Bye.
Yep. We're going to go ahead and take a break here for a couple of minutes. This is Central Coast Voices. I'm talking with Michael Lattner, professor of political science at Cal Poly.
Yeah. Hola, I'm Maria Hinojosa. Every Thursday afternoon at 2, you can hear Latino USA on KCBX. Latino USA is a Peabody Award-winning radio journal of news and culture from a Latino-Latina perspective. It chronicles how we're living, shaping, and changing the United States of America. Tune in for in-depth reporting, candid conversations, and fascinating stories. Join me for Latino USA Thursdays from 2 to 3 on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how the Supreme Court is increasing presidential power. We discuss the term that recently ended, including the so-called shadow docket, look ahead to the next term, and talk about Ketanji Brown Jackson's warning in her dissents and the reaction of the other justices. Our guest, Adam Liptak, covers the court for the New York Times. Join us.
There are a lot of things in the economic world right now that are changing. Like the tax code.
We can't solve our problems with a tax cut. We need to solve it with a tax reform.
It has to be a win-win-win-win-win. And that is very hard to achieve with tax policy.
This happens once in a generation.
I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll guide you through it next time on Marketplace.
China and Taiwan are home to some of the world's most prized regions for growing tea, but higher temperatures and extreme weather events now pose a major threat to harvests, slowing down plant growth and even altering the flavor of the leaves.
The tea makers are like, oh, what are we going to do now? Should we start making or do we wait?
I'm Ari Shapiro. That story on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's a look ahead today here on our Thursday on KCBX with Fresh Air coming up from 3 to 4 right after Latino USA following this program. Then it's Marketplace from 4 to 4:30, and then All Things Considered from 4:30 to 6:30, leading to an evening of music. Right now, let's return to Fred Monroe and his guest on Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Fred.
Thank you, Brad. We're if you're just joining us, this is a very fascinating topic to talk about, the state of our democracy at the moment under many different aspects of the Voting Rights Act and 14th Amendment and citizenship have become factors that have, for lack of a better word, blurred the discussion to some extent. I'm wondering, Michael, by the way, my guest is Michael Lattner. He's a Cal Poly professor of political science, but he's also the director of research on democratic reform at the Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard Law School. He's with us on the phone from Cambridge because he's currently working on that project and he's not at Cal Poly at the moment. Michael, you know, it feels like because we are spending a lot of time in court as a nation, debating shades of gray that we thought were rather black and white, it feels to some extent like there's some weaknesses in our democracy, and I'm not quite sure how we adequately address those weaknesses, and how we get back our democracy if we feel like it's not really here. And having asked that question, I want to remind our listeners that you can give us a call at 805-781-3875. Be part of the discussion. This is a topic that we could talk about for days. We only get an hour today, but I am delighted that we have Michael to be part of this discussion. How did we get to this point, Michael?
Yeah, well, the litigation question is a really important one. In the last redistricting cycle, so, you know, we redraw district boundaries in the U.S. at the local, state, and federal level every 10 years after the census. And part of the reason that we do that is because we have to. Because, again, the question of vote dilution is really important with regard to how districts are drawn. And so one of the primary ways that discriminatory states discriminated against minority voters prior to the Voting Rights Act and prior to the what we call the Second Reconstruction, when we started to really take a look at all these things, was that they just wouldn't redistrict. And so in California is a great example where prior to the Voting Rights Act, the state Senate, those 40 seats, were allocated by counties, not by population. And so Los Angeles County had its seats, and Little Alpine County, right, and small counties, they had seats as well. And what that causes, it's called malapportionment, and it means that you're shoving a bunch of people into a district and then giving the same number of candidates or representatives to much smaller populations, which increases their voting strength, right? And so it was often the case that in highly populated, most of the black populations of a lot of cities in the South was in, you know, the central city district. And so they would just keep, you'd get one representative from those districts, and then the rural white counties would have a lot more representatives. And so that that way of districting or not districting was outlawed. And so now we have to redistrict. We redistrict every 10 years. But that process itself has become so politicized because the stakes are so high. Both major parties spend hundreds of millions of dollars preparing for litigation every redistricting cycle because it's one of the ways that they fight for control and political power. And a lot of money is spent, a lot of expert time is used, including my own, on ensuring that we have free and fair districts. And that's an arduous process that costs an enormous amount of money. And both parties are you know, actively engaged in trying to shape the districts that state legislatures draw and that localities draw because the stakes are so high. And I would argue that that's one of the reasons why we're seeing this erosion in support for both major parties. You're seeing it in terms of a greater demand for other forms of representation. More than two-thirds of Americans want a third or fourth or other parties to choose from. And so that's another element of what we're looking at here in terms of why our democracy has weakened to the point where we could be overrun by populist forces or other forces. And part of that has to do with the weakness of our parties. Our parties are looking out largely for themselves. They are powerful, nationalized agents, but they're also incredibly weak in the sense that they're a product of the donor classes and those who control the electoral rules, and that always does not work in the interest of the average American. And I think people are starting to get a sense of that now, and you're seeing basically the bottom erode from the party system. Yeah. And
Michael, I want to interject for a second. We have yeah. a caller. I want to give them an opportunity to get on the line here. Sorry about that.
Absolutely.
Linda, are you with us there? Hi, Linda. You're on the air. I'm not Linda. Sorry, Carol.
Hi. Thanks. Well, you may consider me a simplistic thinker, but I think we're overcomplicating things as far as the 14th Amendment. It seems to me it says any person born in the United States is a citizen. It doesn't say if you're white or if you're Mexican or if you're Chinese or anything like that. So I don't understand how it got so damn complicated, because it seems pretty clear to me. Now, I don't know. I'm a college graduate, so I'm fairly intelligent and I know history, so I don't get it.
Michael, you want to respond, please?
I guess my response would be that I agree with your assessment of what the 14th Amendment means, but I think it's also important to keep in mind that there is a battle going on for what America is, right? And this is not new. This is something that is as old as the Republic. And the framing documents, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, especially the Declaration, right? These are aspirational documents. And so much of American political history has been the challenge and the fight to overcome our barriers that keep us from being a government by and for the people. And so there is a vision, a fairly popular and empowered vision of America that is much more exclusive, that has a particular origin story, and that is to a lot of things like minority rights and equal opportunity. And there's a contrasting vision of the U.S. that that seeks to aspire to be the country that we want to be, a country that is a model for others, a country that is based on the idea of immigration, that we are all immigrants, a country that aspires to the ideal of political equality, that is, that we are all equal under the law. And you know, we are neither of those things, right? We're a competition over different contrasting visions, and so we're sort of at a boiling point right now. It's not the first time that we've been here, this is where we are.
But I still think we overcomplicate. It's like how many angels fit on the head of a pin. I mean, you know, I might remind you that Mark Twain once said, "In our population, there are criminals, and there are politicians." But I rest my case.
And yeah.
It seems to me that, I mean, it's clear if it limited in some way, and how dare people in modern time try to limit it when it's so inconsistent with the clarity of the language.
Michael, I would love for us to have this Q&A with a couple of members of the Supreme Court. Because a lot of things are black and white, and sometimes there are infinite shades of gray, And sometimes there's just flat out too many shades of gray. And I think somehow we've gotten into the too many shades of gray.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, for sure, we see those competing visions on the Supreme Court, without a doubt.
Well, yeah, but we have to decide if we're an inclusive society or an exclusive. And it seems to me the Constitution was fairly written by some fairly brilliant men that said that we are not an elitist country. We embrace everyone. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, it can be difficult to come to terms with the consequences of our actions, right? I mean, getting back to the earlier conversation, the original Constitution ratified in 1787 punted on a lot of very important questions, and that turned out to be very consequential. Indeed, it led to a civil war, right? And it was only after the Civil War where there was an agreement among the branches of government and the passage of those Civil War amendments that we had to have a national version of citizenship that we could no longer continue doing. And then hopefully we won't make the same mistakes of the past. Well, but our memories are not lost.
If it was meant to be exclusive, wouldn't the Constitution have read birthright citizenship in the 13 original colonies? I'm exasperated, as you can tell.
Yeah. And Carol, I think we all are, which is one reason why I invited Michael to have this conversation with us today, because we may not get a completely better understanding, but at least he's giving us some understanding of where we are, and to some extent, as we have this discussion, maybe we'll learn how to get back to where we want to be. Thanks for the call.
I hope so. Thank you.
Yeah, take care.
You're welcome. I mean, that is the goal, Fred, is to reorient and remind people that democracy is not a spectator sport, that we have to organize and mobilize and fight for the freedoms that we believe in.
Is the current political situation in our country making it is it surprising for people like you that we are where we are and that the shades of gray, if you will, have become too cluttered?
No. I think if you take the real long look, right, that the sort of historical comparative look, democracies are awfully vulnerable, right? And sometimes democracies just die. And indeed, most democracies die, or at least go through some period of authoritarian rule. And from that long perspective, we've had a pretty good run. Our Constitution has proved amazingly resilient. And it is certainly being tested now. But I think it's also important to keep in mind that, you know, the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. That wasn't all that long ago. And I'm certainly too young to remember a pre-1965 world, but I was born in 1971, and there were still plenty of institutional structural barriers to political equality then. The VRA was still just being implemented. And I'm certainly old enough to remember South Africa and the apartheid state there. I mean, I was in high school when that fell, and that's basically what the South was like for 100 years after the fall of the first Reconstruction. And so we go through periods, right? I mean, this is not the story of democracy is not one of linear progression. It's a story of backsliding and gains made and new barriers put up, and that's part of the story of democracy. That's part of the story of the United States. So at the end of the day, you know, I am optimistic that we're going to advance to the next stage of where our democracy should be, but it's not going to be without turbulence.
We seem to have moved into an interesting area, for lack of a better way of putting it, with regard to what we consider to be civil rights and equal protection under the law, because like our last caller, I see or saw the language on the 14th Amendment to be pretty straightforward. If you were born here, you got to be a citizen, and that was not a not something that just could get taken away. We're now looking at situations where that becomes a debate that's just continuing on, but it's also becoming a topic as to whether or not we can take away citizenship.
Sure.
It scares me.
It should. It should. It's it is frightening, and it behooves us all to remember that both with regard to voting rights and civil rights more broadly, that there was for two generations a strong consensus where the Republican Party and the Democratic Party both worked to solidify and protect voting rights. The Voting Rights Act was reinforced and was strengthened over decades with majorities, super majorities of members of both parties. Similarly, go back to the language that George W. Bush, that Ronald Reagan used regarding immigration. Right, this is a very different time that we're in. There was consensus among the branches of government, among members of parties on our basic attitudes towards immigrants and towards towards minority rights, and those have shifted. There is certainly a break in the consensus, and there's been a disruption of that consensus, and so we've got to fight through it.
I think as we look at history, I'm surprised that we have this discussion sometimes, but I'm also surprised that we got to a point where we look at some things that were supported by Ronald Reagan as being too far to the left.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's certainly, and as a California native, I think we all have a special relationship with Ronald Reagan, and as a person, a member of a union family, we had a particularly distasteful memory of Ronald Reagan during his presidency. At least my family did. My dad was a pipe fitter, and Reagan was not a friend with the unions. But certainly, when we look at what Reagan aspired to, right, an actual conservative vision, that is completely absent in the United States today. There is no conservative party. We have effectively a cult of personality, a very personalistic party. Then it's hard to say what it stands for on a day-to-day basis, but certainly not any of the conservative principles that the Republican Party used to stand for. And frankly, the Democratic Party isn't looking too great either, right? I mean, we had a very unusual election where we had the nominee replaced at the last minute. And even in, you know, more recently, looking at the Democratic Party's response to the election of a progressive mayor in New York, you know, that there are signs that both parties are in big trouble.
Yeah. Michael, as I often do with the program, is I try and make sure my guests get kind of the last word. We're down to the last few minutes. What would you like our listeners to leave this discussion with as a better understanding of where they might want to proceed or understand better?
Well, I guess I would just remind people that institutions don't run themselves, right? And the U.S. Constitution, this extraordinarily resilient document, has operated for as many generations as it has because of norms, because of the norm of the rule of law, and in that we respect the rules even if we aren't winners. That hasn't always been respected, and certainly we have a much more exclusionary history than we would like to remind ourselves of, I think. But at the end of the day, the brilliance of the rule of law and constitutional democracy is that we can live up to its ideals, and we can reestablish those norms. We can certainly restore and advance and be a better democracy than we've ever been. But it's going to take a struggle. And it's I think that that struggle is now more apparent to people than it was maybe a few years ago. But I'm optimistic that we'll meet the challenge.
I'm optimistic that we can at least continue the discussion. So I think I would agree with you, and I always appreciate your being part of this discussion. We've been visiting with Michael Latner, Cal Poly Professor of Political Science and Director of Research in Democratic Reform at the Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard Law School. Michael, you'll be back with us again as soon as we can have you here, because you always have good things to add to the discussion. This has been Central Coast Voices, and I thank you all for joining us today. Chris Kington Barker is off next week, so I'll be with you again as we revisit the issue of disaster preparedness. Every day we are reminded of the need to be prepared in the time of crisis, and as we're seeing from both a history of wildfires in California and still active right now, and flooding in Texas and New Mexico, this is a discussion you may want to be part of. I will be talking with fire and crisis specialists next week about how we prepare ourselves for those kinds of challenges. This has been Central Coast Voices, which is a production of KCBX Public Radio. We're glad you can join us today. Your input to Central Coast Voices is always appreciated. You can give us an email at voices@kcbx.org. If you want any information or questions forwarded on to my guest today, give us an email at voices@kcbx.org. Thank you to our listener-supported radio station that's probably so key to the Central Coast that we need to remember that every day. And, of course, Brad Kyle, our in-studio engineer, who's been with us today. And thanks to our guest, Michael Latner. Michael has always been a wonderful asset to this program and in this community, and I thank you for being part of it, Michael. This has been Central Coast Voices. We will talk with you soon. Thank you for joining us today.